Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum, a venue for spoken word presentations in many forms. We feature writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm your host, John O'Brien. The annual Citizen University Conference brings together community leaders, artists, and activists to discuss the art and practice of citizenship. Their motto is, "Let's do democracy." The gathering evolved out of the work of the Guiding Lights Network, founded by author and educator Eric Liu in 2005. The theme this year was Citizen Power Now. To that end, participants focused on best practices for problem-solving in a climate of political polarization. Labor organizer Ai-Jen Poo gave the conference keynote address, "The Future of Elder Care," on day one. Poo is the director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. She received a MacArthur Genius Award in 2014. Her book, The Age of Dignity, Preparing for the Elder Boom in a Changing America, was published this year. Following her speech, Ai-Jen Poo joined Carmen Rojas of the Workers Lab, Susie Young of SEIU, Sylvia Gonzalez of Casa Latina, and moderator Eric Liu in a panel discussion on dignity and economic justice. The Citizen University National Conference took place at Seattle Center on March 20th and 21st, 2015. Sponsors included Seattle Center, the Seattle Foundation, and KUOW 94.9. The opening music for this session was performed by composer and visual artist Paul Rucker. Thanks to Anna Tadashev for our recording.
My name is Eric Liu, and I just want to take a moment to actually invite you to look around at each other at this room, because this is an awesome room of humans. This is a beautiful and powerful room of humans, and I'm really gratified to be in your company tonight. We begin this conference tonight with a simple purpose: to get powerful. The whole theme of this year's conference, the whole theme of all of the work that we do at Citizen University is power, naming it, unpacking it, making it more visible, making it more accessible, and becoming more literate in power. And we'll have a whole lot more to say about that. But some of the things that we're going to prefigure in tonight's opening program have to do with these notions of power, but also connected notions when you think about what it means to be an engaged and fully participating member of the civic body in the United States. Notions like dignity. Notions like care. Notions like compassion and empathy. Across lines not only of color, but of class, of creed, of region, of party. And our ability, our willingness, not even so much primarily at the level of the head, but the level of the heart, the parts of us that get activated by performance like that of Paul Rucker, our job here is to activate all of ourselves in the spirit of exploring and unpacking these words that we look past every single day: power, justice, dignity, care. And we are blessed today. I want to give you just a quick run of show for what we're going to experience tonight. In just a moment, I'm going to hand over the mic and turn the podium over to Ai-Jen Poo. And by the way, for tonight and throughout tomorrow, I'm not going to rehearse people's bios. You've got them all in the program. You can figure out who they are. But suffice it to say, Ai-Jen Poo is literally and figuratively a genius of not only organizing, but again, of cracking open this wider conversation about care and dignity in civic life. And from Ai-Jen's opening remarks, we're going to segue into the first of two very connected panel conversations this evening. The first one is going to be on economic justice, and the second one will be on racial justice. And the themes will be interwoven throughout. There will be beats laid down the way that Paul was laying them down at the beginning that you'll hear reverberating later on in the evening. And there will be beats that will begin to get laid down tonight that you will hear reverberating tomorrow throughout the day. And so even though this evening's program is designed in a discrete way where we're all going to be seated like this together, and tomorrow we'll be in round tables and having breakout sessions and the rest, it's all one arc. It's all one arc of learning. And the only other thing I want to say before we get this show on the road is there are going to be some folks who our team at Citizen University has spent great care and great heart curating, inviting to the space to be on stage and to share some of their stories and their voices and their ideas with you. And at the same time, we are called Citizen University for a reason. We believe that everybody has something to teach everybody. We believe that the knowledge and the experience and the wisdom that every one of you brings to a room like this is worth sharing with each other. And so there will be beats tonight, there will be beats certainly throughout the day tomorrow, where you're going to get to share with one another who you are, what you do, where you're from, why you do what you do, why you care about what you care about, and how we can all together build something all together. So that is the spirit of what we're doing here this evening. And one of the final things that I'd like to say just at the outset here is to thank a few friends, partners, sponsors. First of all, I want to thank our team at Citizen University for organizing, putting this on. That's our staff team. That's our volunteer team. That's an incredible number of folks who've helped make tonight and tomorrow possible. Let's please give the team a hand. I want to also thank our sponsors, all of whom are listed and named on the back of our programs, without whom we would not be here, and whose support has been so giving and strategic. Last of all, I want to thank all of you for being here. We have a lot of friends in the house. We have a lot of people who are going to be your new friends. We have a lot of organizations in the Action Zone set up that are here to tell you about their work. We have our friends at Elliott Bay Books here to sell the books. And after our program ends tonight, there will be some book signing for some of the authors who are in our program, so stick around there. And then our friends also from the Seattle Channel and others who are documenting today and tomorrow. We're really grateful to all of them. So without further ado, let me now turn the stage over to Ai-Jen Poo, founder of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, a very recent awardee of the MacArthur Genius Fellowship, leader of a campaign called Caring Across Generations, and my heroine.
Good evening. Good evening. Can we get another round of applause for Eric Liu and the Citizen University team? And are you ready for Citizen University? Are you ready to get powerful? Are you ready to get powerful? All right, let's get this party started. One of my favorite speeches of all time is a speech that the author George Saunders gave during the 2013 Syracuse University commencement. And in speaking to the young graduates, Saunders helped them anticipate their futures. He said, "The things we regret most in life are not the things that you might expect, but rather failures in kindness. Those moments when another human being was there, suffering, in front of us, and we responded sensibly, reservedly, mildly. To look at it from the other end of the telescope, who in your life do you remember with the most fondness, the most undeniable feelings of warmth? Those who were kindest to you." Saunders goes on to admit that kindness is in fact not easy, but he believes that kindness comes more easily with age. He quotes the poet Hayden Carruth, who wrote near the end of his life that he was mostly love now. Saunders wished for the graduates to embrace this awareness early, avoiding failures of kindness and instead striving to be ever more kind and connected to others, and ultimately, mostly love. I come from an immigrant family and had the great gift of growing up with my grandparents. I don't know if they grew to become mostly love, but they certainly were there by the time that I came into the world. How many of you grew up with your grandparents around a lot? right? Enough of us, so you know what I'm talking about. They showered my sister and me with kindness. They cared for us. They laughed with us, offered very important perspective on life. From my grandmother, I learned how to appreciate and cultivate laughter. I learned how to use the potty, which was very useful. Turned out, still useful. My grandmother also taught me to cook. While admittedly, that's still a work in progress. We're still actively working on that one. My grandfather, he was a Tai Chi master, and from him I learned Tai Chi. I learned hard work and discipline, and developed a deep appreciation for the hidden strategies of the television show Wheel of Fortune. I feel so fortunate to have been cared for by both of them. Two extraordinary people on different sides of my family, but very similar life experiences. Early life defined by poverty and war in China, migration, hard work, each a full life of hardship and triumph. And then their stories diverge. My paternal grandfather lived to the age of 93, a long and for the most part healthy life. However, the final months will haunt me forever. After my grandfather's vision and other functions deteriorated, my father was unable to find him appropriate home care support and had to place him in a nursing home against his wishes. And I will never forget my first visit to him there. Even now, my memory of that visit gives me the shivers. My grandfather's bed was in a dark room with about a half a dozen other people. Some completely still and unmoving, others wailing in pain and suffering. It smelled of mold and illness, and when I found him, it was clear my grandfather had not eaten or slept for days. Though he was alive enough to tell me that he was afraid, I knew that he was dying inside, and he passed away after just 3 months in that frightening facility. Now, on the other hand, my maternal grandmother is still alive, and today is her birthday. She turns 89 today. I just came from visiting her. We just celebrated Lunar New Year together, the year of the ram, sheep, goat, whichever you choose. She lives in her own apartment in Southern California across the street from a Chinese grocery, not far from the Chinese hair salon where they know how to do her perm just right. She goes to church twice a week. She even sings in the church senior choir. That's her singing. She and I play mahjong together. She's really quite good at mahjong, and she on occasion lets me win, usually on my birthday, so about once a year. She's living life on her own terms at 89, and it brings me so much joy to know that she's living well now after caring for so many of us, so many of our generations in our family. Two grandparents, both made of strong stock, both loved dearly by my family. So what made the difference in their experience? Mrs. Sun. Mrs. Sun is the home care worker who looks after my grandmother. A few times a week, Mrs. Sun comes and assists her with the things that have become more difficult with age, things like lifting, cleaning, cooking, although sometimes they cook together, it's a team effort, buying groceries. Our last big scare was when my grandmother slipped and fell as she was rushing to catch the bus to go to church. And so now Mrs. Sun or her husband always to make sure that my grandmother gets to church on time. Mrs. Sun is an immigrant from China also and has become a key part of my family's care team. Her own family of two grown sons and a husband have also become like extended family to us. Now, like so many families with aging relatives, we did not have a plan. That lack of a plan and lack of options proved painful in the case of my grandfather. A few years later, in the case of my grandmother, we simply lucked out finding Mrs. Sun. We were just fortunate. Having her has changed everything, especially my grandmother's quality of life. What's become clear to me in this moment is that we as a country don't have a plan either. Whether you're an overstretched family caregiver or you can't afford the care you need, or you can't find the right long-term care option for your family, you are not alone. It's all of us. And it's gotten to the point where we as individuals, as families, and as a nation can't afford not to have a plan. Because every 8 seconds, someone turns 65 in America today. This year, 4 million of us will reach retirement age. And by the year 2030, 20% of our population will be over the age of 65. The baby boom generation is aging, plus advances in healthcare and medicine have extended our life expectancy by more than 20 years since 1930. The combined effect is what some call the silver tsunami. I prefer the term elder boom, but whatever you call it, what this means is that by the year 2050, 27 million of us will need some form of care or assistance just to meet our basic daily needs. But for the vast, vast majority of Americans, care doesn't mean living at home on our own terms with the assistance of someone like Mrs. Sun. For most, elder care will mean something more akin to what my grandfather experienced in a nursing home, unless we do something very, very different. And that dark ending that my grandfather faced is too costly. There's an emotional cost of what he endured and the feeling of failure that my family still lives with every day. But then there's also a financial cost. The average nursing home private room stay per year is $87,000. That's literally unimaginable for 27 million Americans, perhaps even not possible. So then perhaps the solution is simple. If we simply had more caregivers like Mrs. Sun, the more than 90% of us who would prefer to age at home, in our communities, connected to our families, could actually age the way we want to, right? Simple. Well, not exactly. Because the more than 2 million women who currently work as home care workers, personal care aides, and domestic caregivers today can barely sustain in their jobs. It's the kind of job that people don't even recognize as a real job. Some call it companionship, some call it help. And many of the workers in this workforce are undocumented immigrants trapped in the shadows. The wages are unfathomably low. There's no inclusion in basic labor protections. Average wages are often less than $9 per hour, so low that the women, mostly women of color, who we count on to care for our loved ones, can't take care of their own families. It's to the point where 30% of home care workers must rely on public assistance for food security, and many live in fear of being separated from their own families as a result of our immigration policies. Mirla Baldonado is a Filipina caregiver in Chicago who helps elders in the community live independently. She's had over 20 clients working 24-hour shifts 4 days a week, lifting her clients in and out of bed, bathing, administering medicine, helping do physical therapy, plus cooking and cleaning, skilled work around the home. For this work, Mirla takes home between $5 and $9 per hour. And what does Mirla then do? Because she's also a parent, she sends some of this money home to her children in the Philippines. But with that, plus the cost of the room that she lives in, she barely has any money left over. And on several occasions, Mirla has told me that she has gone for weeks surviving on nothing but hard-boiled eggs and bananas. She simply can't make ends meet. So we can stay on this same dark path of unsustainable home care wages and working conditions, reinforcing an unsustainable overdependence on nursing homes that no one wants to live in. Or we can seize upon this moment of opportunity and change to create a whole new approach to care, a system to care for our families and care for the workers too. Think of this as a care grid, like the grid of infrastructure that once brought water, electricity, maybe someday the internet to every home in America, We need a care grid to bring caregiving options to every home in this country. And if we look closely enough, all around us, we start to see the seeds of what's possible, the seeds of the future. We have naturally occurring retirement communities and the village movement, designed as communities of older people to pool resources and purchasing power and share services that enhance quality of life, including caregivers. In Hawaii, Champions will be introducing the first state social insurance program for long-term care this legislative session. And in just the last 4 years, domestic workers, caregivers, have won statewide legislation to establish basic rights and protections in 4 states, with Massachusetts passing one of the strongest bills to date in 2014, including maternity leave for caregivers. And right here, yes, we can clap for maternity leave. Right here in the great state of Washington, SEIU Local 775 has created the country's top training facility for home care workers, training over 40,000 professional caregivers per year, speaking 12 different languages, utilizing the most cutting-edge training content and methodology. This facility has elevated the quality of care for people of this state and the quality of these caregiving jobs. And as a result, Washington is among the more prepared states in the nation for what's to come. We should clap for that. These examples are just the beginning of what's needed. The care grid of the future must be a connective lifeline of creative solutions and choices our families, communities, legislatures, and entrepreneurs create together. It will have the capacity to support all of us to live at our highest potential through all stages of life, while bringing poverty wage jobs out of the shadows, transforming them into millions of good jobs for the future. This is our moment to take caregiving, what has been a private, often isolated conversation, into the national public conversation about the future of our nation. Another caregiver whose story I write about, Erlinda, shared about a client that she calls My Lady, who always used to ask her to sing to her because Erlinda has a beautiful voice. One particular day, rather than ask her to sing, she said, "Give me your hand." And Erlinda knew right away that she was going to transition. So she called the family together, and together they stayed with her lady. She was proud that she could be there for that moment, and that she could ensure her dear lady was in good hands and surrounded by love in that moment. Just as the family remembers Erlinda's kindness, Erlinda thinks of her lady often, every time she sings, in fact. We remember in life, and ultimately rely on, at the end of our lives, those who are kindest to us. We need a care system that is mostly love, a care grid that channels dignity and enhances choice and respect and health and self-determination, and fairness, and love. Especially as more and more of us age and hopefully grow in kindness, we need a care system that cares for all of us, including the workers. And in creating such a system, we will begin to lay the foundation for an economy and a democracy that honors the full diversity of who we are and who we are becoming, opening up jobs with real pathways to opportunity and citizenship and new supports for workers, immigrants, and our elders, people of all generations and walks of life, to live and work with dignity. And to be clear, the demographic shifts in this country that are underway are profound. By 2040, we will be a majority people of color nation, and over 20% of our population will be over the age of 65. The older population will be significantly whiter, and the younger population will be more of color. We could run the risk of becoming the kind of country where our interests are constantly pitted against one another along lines of race and generation. Or we can present an alternative vision for the future of this country, one where we actually take care of one another. It will be up to us to make it clear that there is a shared vision for the future of this nation, for healthy, secure American families that benefits all of us, and that coming together toward that vision will ultimately make the country, make all of us, more whole and connected. Care can connect us all. It's a vision for a more caring, just future for all of us, and it will take all of us to create. I hope you will join us. Thank you.
You are a wonderful, joyful, loving person.
You are like a father figure to me.
You are. Just gentle.
We care about each other, and we take an interest in each other.
Before I came to this country, I was taking care of my grandmother. So I felt that I can do the job.
I took it for granted that, you know, if I wanted to do anything, I would get up, go out shopping, visiting people. Unfortunately, that's no longer the case.
I noticed you were changing years ago.
After I being able to get you to go outside, I got the opportunity then to go places with you.
When I got home from rehab after being away for over 3 months, the first thing I saw were 8 balloons that you had put up around my door, welcoming me back. And I knew I was truly home.
I am totally honored to be a caregiver for you. It is a great privilege and a joy for me.
There are so many things that I still can't do that I depend on you to help me. And the help is given so freely and with so much love, and that makes me feel a lot better. And still independent, but as I said, independent with benefits.
We are not only just caregivers. You are a nutritionist, you are a nurse, you're the doctor.
You are my mother, Julie Davis, and you are loved by a whole lot of people.
You're Dr. Morris Steiner. You are my patient. You're a pediatrician, war veteran. You have taught me things that I know would take me through the rest of my life.
You are my community, but you're even more than that. You are my friends. And as much as you've done for me, there's nothing that I wouldn't do for you also.
Invite our panelists to come up to the stage now for this first panel discussion. And as they do, I just want to invite us all again to give a round of applause to iGen for her words and for her work. iGen's going to be joining this panel. You know, I have to say, one of the things that is so it's just so moving to remember that everything that we talk about when it comes to policy and politics and civic life and engaging on issues boils down very simply to the kinds of things that iGen was describing, whether there are going to be successes or failures of kindness. That's kind of it. Whether we are going to be successful or we will fail at kindness. If we succeed at it, then many other things are both possible and necessary. But if we fail at it, then almost everything else we might want to try to do via program, via government, via policy, will hit a too early ceiling of effectiveness. And so I just really want to thank iGen for setting us in this frame and open up this conversation now. We have with us just a remarkable group of leaders, practitioners, and the wrong panel listed up on the slide there. I see. And so we will find the right panel. But you can also see in your programs who we've got here. And I'm just going to say a quick word about them and then open up a conversation here. Actually, you know what? Before I'll introduce the panel first. Then I want to ask you all to do something. So immediately to my left here is Carmen Rojas of the Workers Lab, founding CEO of the Workers Lab. And Carmen's presence reminds me to note that this evening's segment with iGen and this conversation here is brought to you in partnership with Reclaiming Prosperity, an initiative that SEIU 775 and others have driven in this community to frame up a variety of issues, some on policy and some on the spirit level of the impacts of inequality and the opportunities that we have to build a truly just and dignified and caring community. So welcome, Carmen. Next to Carmen is Susie Young from SEIU 775 Northwest, who knows a few people in the room. and then next to her, iGen, and then next to iGen, Sylvia Gonzalez, who is herself a caregiver. And an active member of Casa Latina here in Seattle. And remind me your name.
Carino,
who will be doing some simultaneous translation as we go forward in this conversation. But before we begin this conversation, we actually thought it would be helpful also. I want to give a shout out to somebody who should be sitting in this chair right now. Courtney Martin was going to be scheduled to moderate this panel. She's listed in your program. She fell very ill, wasn't able to fly to Seattle. So I'm pinch hitting, but I want you to take a look at the work of Courtney Martin and her husband, John Carey, because they've been doing remarkable work bringing together generations of people around this country on civic imagination. But I want to begin this conversation actually with you having a conversation. I would like you to each turn to somebody next to you and for a minute each, describe somebody who has been a caregiver to you. Someone who has cared for you. That may be in a professional sense, it may not be, but someone who has cared for you in your life. So go for a minute each, and then we'll bring it back in 2 minutes. This is going to be kind of hard this evening. I'm just kind of moved to tears at various points here, just hearing these stories and hearing you share these stories. And I want to begin, I guess, with story also here as we open up this panel and ask each of our panelists, you know, one of the words that we have already talked about this evening and that iGen was emphasizing, this word and notion of dignity. You know, I guess I would like each of you to share an instance where in your own life, as a member of our community, you have been treated either with dignity or memorably without dignity. And just to share that experience with us. Carmen, why don't we start with you?
Sure. Good evening, everyone. And thank you so much, Eric, for having me. Both Susie and iGen heard this story earlier. And when I was given this question, it brought up so many different stories, right? Stories of being a kid of recent immigrants and seeing people humiliate my parents because they had heavy accents, and not feeling very powerless in those situations. And then, frankly, stories of being one of the very few women of color in my professional life, and the small aggressions that happen when you are the only one. And I dug back into my greatest crates of dignity. And it was a story, actually, that involved Ai-jin. Early in my career, I lost a job that I really loved. It was like a job that that at the moment felt like it wholly defined me. It was like one of my first jobs. And because of an organizational shift, I lost in it and was like such a blow. And it was a blow personally into my ego because I couldn't explain it. And it was like a real blow. I was like the kid who graduated from college. And so it was, you know, I had tens of thousands of dollars of college debt and rent. And I was the one who was supporting my family. And so I reached out to a network. And I'd recently met Ai-jin at a conference. I can't remember exactly where. And just loved her spirit. And I felt like she was always very open. And so I reached out to a network of people and was like, okay, like, what can I do next? And my impulse, because I'm the only one, was like, I had a mom who was a secretary, and I had an uncle who had a cleaning company. And I was like, well, if things get really bad, I can go and work for my uncle's cleaning company. And I have a PhD. And that was like my initial impulse, right? It was like, well, at least I can clean a house. You know, like, I can, like, I'm going to be able to do it. And people around me were like, no, actually, you're going to have a bunch of different opportunities. And I reached out to Ai-jin, and Ai-jin was really generous with her time. And we had a conversation, and I started telling her about the opportunities in front of me and feeling like I was too young, I was too inexperienced, I'd just finished school. And Ai-jin said to me, Carmen, what you need to do is be clear that your time to lead is now, that there's no such thing as an emerging leader, that you're a leader today. And you have to figure out what it is that you love and actually do that thing. And it was a pivot point for me, both personally and professionally, because it opened up so much room for me to be curious about the life in front of me, right? That, like, the stories behind me weren't so self-defining. So that's my story.
It's a really, you know, you're telling that story reminds me of something that I noticed when Ai-jin was speaking on stage. I don't know if you all noticed this, but you know about the whole theory of mirror neurons, right? That when you see someone's expression, you just kind of automatically, we are wired as social beings to kind of mirror their expression, right? And there were two different instances in Ai-jin's talk where she basically posed a situation where there's two paths. We could either go down the path of conflict and zero-sum hatred along lines of race, class, and generation. Or, right, whenever she said or, she had a big, beautiful smile on her face, right? And I kind of automatically also began to smile at the or, right? And that's sort of a story, you know, Carmen, where, you know, I can either, okay, chuck the PhD and clean houses, right? Or with a big smile, right? And I think that sense of possibility is so crucial not only to thinking about dignity and care, but to kind of set up the conversations we're going to have about so many of the false choices that plague our politics, right? That there are ors to be created with a smile and with hope that come down to these kinds of stories. I'm going to kind of get out of order here, and actually I would like to go to Sylvia here to share a story about dignity.
Sure, why not? You know, dignity means respect, honor, and value to people. Human dignity, it's a value or an unbreakable and intangible right of a person. It's a fundamental right, and it's an inherent value to human because it's a rational being who has the freedom and it's able to create things no matter we are immigrants, citizens, people of color, young or old. We all have right to be treated with dignity. What can employer do to make me feel treated with dignity? It's a question. give value to my work, but also have a living wage, especially for domestic workers. Offer sick leave, dental benefits, medical insurance, vacations. Since the 30s, we have been fighting to be included in the Bill of Rights without success. And this is why respect and dignity might have been lost for this type of work. We have worked hard in the campaign for minimum wage on $50 in Seattle with the leadership of the SEIU 775, 15 Now, King County Labor Council, and another partner like Casa Latina. Speaking especially of the field of care, and if I can mention some data from the Age of Dignity. In this city, caregivers earn an average of $10 to $12 an hour to care for our parents, grandparents, or people who actually need care. These caregivers have to take 70 hours of training, have to pass a state test, and all this thing and process for only $12 an hour? And we talk of dignity? Many compañeras prefer go to clean house where they will earn $60 to $20 per hour. As an immigrant and activist, I see a lot of my compañeras working in the shadow without demanding dignity and respect for being a free or threat of deportation. It is why we work together in the care campaign of the National Domestic Worker Alliance 6, 2007. One of the five main pillars of this campaign is a path to citizenship. As a caregiver, I want to be treated with dignity, but also treat people with dignity. For I remember that someone called my mother in my country. She has 83 years old. She kept, how can no sit independent of someone want to be treated with dignity and respect at home? But si se puede.
Thank you, Sylvia. Susie, how about for you, and then I'm going to open up a new line of questioning here.
Okay. So to me, dignity is about respect, and it's also about a feeling of worthiness. I've been a home care worker for over 30 years. So I was a home care worker way before I became a member of SEIU, which was back in 2003. And so for many, many years, I think any low-wage worker, whether you're a home care worker or an airport worker or a child care worker, if you're a low-wage worker, no one treats you with any dignity and respect. No one looks you in the eye. No one wants to hear your story. You have no hope. You also are not treated that way because our wages are so low. You don't have any benefits at all. You have no sick day pay. And at one time, I voted against a union. I'm a private sector home care agency worker. And I thought, I'll take good care of my clients, and my agency is going to take good care of me. That didn't happen. So one day, SEIU is in our parking lot. And I thought, this is it. We need to form a union now. So back in 2003, we formed a union. We said yes to the union. And you know what? One of the things they wanted to know is our stories. SEIU staff, they wanted to listen to us. I thought, wow, this is different. We learned to find our voices together. And I didn't know where our wages came from. I didn't know that our wages were tied to the state budget. And we learned to tell our stories. We learned to tell them to the right people, to our legislators, to our governor. We testified in front of the House, in front of the Senate. We advocated for our clients. And we now came out of the shadows. We now no longer felt invisible anymore. We now had hope. We now are treated with dignity and respect. Finally, once we came together and found the power that we had in our voices. We have always treated our clients with the utmost dignity and respect, and we now finally, 40,000 home care workers in the state of Washington, now feel that we have a voice and treated with respect.
You know, Susie, that really just segues so powerfully to something that has been implicit in a lot of everything that all of you have been saying, and that certainly, iGen, you were saying in your remarks. iGen, in kind of typical modesty, described how a thing or two happened, about how various states passed a domestic workers' bill of rights, about how organizing of these domestic workers and others to have voice and to have clout changed the game. She didn't mention that she had a rather direct role in doing that organizing and making sure that states and their legislatures enacted these domestic workers' bills of rights. But I want to just ask you, iGen, you know, to draw this connection now that Susie has sketched here between dignity and power, between the seeking of respect and the actual claiming and, in a sense, taking of voice and power so that respect is paid. How, in your work, did you come to build that bridge and see that simply trying to move people on an emotional level and simply trying to, you know, get people to feel on this stuff wasn't going to be enough, that you're going to have to engage in the kind of public and civic mechanisms of power?
Well, when in 1998, when I first started organizing with domestic workers in New York, it was very slow and incremental, right? It took a lot of work to get eight women in a room together. But as soon as the word started to spread that there was a place where we could come together and be powerful, share our stories, but have those stories translate into more power, recognition, respect, visibility. Every caregiver and domestic worker inherently knows the value of their work. They know what they offer the families that they support, the dignity and the value of that work. Every domestic worker knows that if domestic workers and caregivers all went on strike, every single sector of this economy would be impacted, right? It's the work that makes all other work possible. And yet there's this tremendous disconnect between the value of that work and the way that it is valued in our society. And they realized that coming together collectively with a plan to build and exercise their collective voice and power could actually bridge the gap between the true value and worth of their work and the way that society sees it. And so it was domestic workers themselves who sacrificed days' pay because it's no work, no pay, and they went to the Capitol and they told their stories and they marched and they pushed. And year after year, it was a 7-year campaign that led to the breakthrough of the first domestic worker bill of rights. And it was domestic workers themselves who did it, who also tapped into the stories of the senators and the elected officials who had mothers and grandmothers who were domestic workers, who were raised by domestic workers. And we realized in the course of that storytelling and that organizing that there are powerful relationships that can be leveraged when you're organizing and building a movement, because we all are connected.
Well, one of the things that is a complement to this kind of organizing of voice, organizing of workers to apply pressure to the traditional political system, a complement to that, and a complement also to, you know, traditional union organizing of the sort that's happened here with SEIU 775, is, Carmen, a lot of the work that you're doing now at the Workers' Lab. So, you know, the Workers' Lab is this relatively new platform to help foster innovations in worker organizing, accepting that the traditional model of unions has its pluses and minuses, and it is where it is, but that in this age of technology, in this age of demographic change, in this age of so many other shifts, that we need to be innovative about new ways of worker organizing. And so, Carmen, can you say a word about how what you're seeing in these kind of attempts to innovate and how they connect the dots here also between voice and power?
Yeah, no, I think that there are a couple of really interesting things that I see as general trends. One is like a commitment to revenue generation, right? That organizations can actually own the resources that drive the organizing so that organizers can organize and sort of build power that way. I think, too...
What's an example of that?
So the example that I actually wanted to share with you guys is an organization that partnered, that's been organizing restaurant workers for the last number of years. Organized, they have about 15,000 restaurant workers organized nationally, the Restaurant Opportunity Center. They have a number of restaurants, and they've realized they have this amazing training center called Chow. And they train restaurant workers who are low-wage restaurant workers to move into fine dining, where you have benefits. You can make above $100,000 a year. And the challenge with the training is that you can only take the training, you can only be in the training if you're in the place, right? And so they were like, okay, let's establish a private company, an LLC, generate revenue. And the way that they're going to generate revenue is by gaming Chow. So they are partnering with the lead developer of John Madden Football, a guy from actually Seattle, David Ortiz. They created a team where Rock...
So you mean video games?
Yeah. So they're taking this training program that you would normally have to take in person, you'd have to sit in class, and creating a way for restaurant workers, for low-wage restaurant workers, to be able to use the tool on their phones. They did a survey of their workers and found that almost 85% of them are paying for downloadable games on their phone, and the whole 85% said they would use the game if there was one that would allow them to train, upskill them within the workplace. And so I think one is this revenue generation, and two is this use of technology and social media to organize folks. So another example is Coworker, which is another one of our lab partners, an organization that has been working to create new networks of employees in the workplace. And they've been focused on a number of workplaces, but most notably Starbucks, since we're here in Seattle. met a woman in Atlanta, and the woman who worked at the barista was like, look, in my Starbucks, it gets really hot in the summertime. The air conditioning breaks down, and Starbucks has a policy against visible tattoos, and I can't roll up my sleeves. And so I'm sitting here working, and it's in the sweltering heat. And so they decided to use a social media platform, collect signatures, essentially do some petitioning online, and put up a petition to have Starbucks change its policy against visible tattoos. And within a couple of weeks, we're able to get nearly 5% of global Starbucks employees to sign the petition. They went back out to that 5% and were like, what else do you want to change about your working at Starbucks? And most notably, it was predictable scheduling. People wanted to know more than a week in advance when they were going to work so that they can schedule school and schedule childcare. They put a petition up to the same 5% and got to almost 10% of global Starbucks employees. So I think one is revenue generation, but two is this linking of traditional organizing with technology and social media.
And the latter one, the example you use, is coworker.org, which is a really, check it out. Susie, one of the things that I'm struck by here is sometimes it gets lost in the conversation about dignity and voice and power, that there is a mutuality to all this, right? Sometimes the conversation can play like, if only those who have money and power and employment, positions would give some dignity and recognition and respect to those who do not have it, right? Then everything would be better. But part of what your experience personally and organizationally shows, it seems, is that this is mutual, right? That, or to put it another way, when low-wage workers are treated in degrading ways without dignity, it degrades their employer as well as them, right? It degrades the economy, it degrades the community, it lowers norms of what we just think is okay. And I'm curious, just in your work at SEIU, how you've tried to make that kind of, it's going to be better for everybody when we create a workplace where everybody has higher standards of dignity and recognition.
So in this country today, there's less than 7% of the population that are members of unions today. So we have to rethink this. And what does the future look like for workers? And we've had this discussion at our executive board meetings. And we have decided to invest long-term resources in lifting up low-wage workers in this country. And let's look at different ways we've done this. So, for example, in the city of SeaTac, you had a ballot measure, and you lifted the wages to $15 an hour. That was the whole city. Then we went to Seattle. What happened in Seattle? That wasn't a ballot measure, but it was an ordinance. And you gathered the stories, and you have $15 an hour in the city of Seattle. I'm in Spokane, east of the mountains here, about 300 miles, and I'm working with an organization called Spokane Alliance, which is labor groups as well as churches, kind of stand for social justice stuff. And so we're trying to pass sick day pay. And when we get it done, probably by June, it'll affect 40,000 workers. So where do you start with this? Again, it's one-on-one conversations and you gather the stories. When you're trying to go to $15 an hour, you're gathering the stories about the impact it means to, for me to make $15 an hour, right? Maybe I can go to the movie once a month. Maybe I can buy an ice cream cone for my grandkids. What happens with sick day pay? You're talking to school counselors. What happens with the impact of those kids that are always sick and they come to school and they're passing the germs? We have Spokane Regional Health District that is out there doing research to find out the impact of workers in this city that don't have sick day pay. We are talking one-on-one, gathering the stories. We're talking to Catholic Charities. They see the impact of people that don't have sick day pay. So we're moving, but still, it's organizing, it's one-on-one conversations, and who would it affect? Low-wage workers. People that affect with children, as well as restaurant workers that usually don't have sick day pay. We're gonna meet with the city council, we're gathering our votes. Another thing that we have done is a jobs bill in the city of Spokane. So it took 2 years to work on this. So if in the city of Spokane, if you're going to have, build a project or whatever for the city, you need to hire contractors locally, not from Seattle, not from Canada, not from Idaho, contractor locally. We want you to hire and prevailing wages. We want you to pay, have health insurance. We want 15% to be part of a training program, to be apprenticeship programs. It took us 2 years, gather the stories, pass it in the city council. So now we're organizing 100,000 people in the city of Seattle. We're organizing 40,000 for sick day pay. So we're organizing bigger, but we have to figure out how do you enforce these things. You got $15 an hour in the city of Seattle, you're going to be able to enforce it, right? Great. It's no union contracts.
So one of the things that you mentioned in passing there and got alluded to earlier was this, that Ijen mentioned in her remarks, this remarkable example here in Washington State of a training partnership to really elevate the quality and the content of the training of home care aides in a way that not only makes the care better, but actually also justifies a living wage and creates a ladder to professional development. And that training partnership is an example here of how it ends up being good for everybody, right? It does have upfront costs, but it ends up being good for the workers, certainly, but for those whom they are giving care to, and indeed, ultimately, for the employers as well. And that part of the mutuality of the story is something that is not just a theory, but has been a concrete example here in the state. Sylvia, I want to pose a question to you just about your journey from being a domestic worker to being an activist. When did you make that leap, and was it a sudden leap, or was it a gradual transition?
Good question. But Carino, help me a little bit for a translator tonight. Please.
Use the microphone.
Yeah. No, Carino, speak for me.
Okay.
Hace tres años.
Sí, el micrófono para que solamente. 3 years ago, I arrived at Casa Latina looking for a job as a domestic worker. My daughter went to college, and I began to see more need for more money. My daughter, as an immigrant, had difficulties to find financial aid and help at school with her roommates. And I began to see a need for struggle. And that's what inspired me more to continue being involved in the struggle, or find a way to be in the struggle. Casa Latina is an organization, a nonprofit organization, but it has a group of women where leadership is very strong and is part of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. And when we see the need of all the compañeras, where they're not treated with dignity, but we talk to them about the rights that we have, and that yes, we can, that gave me power, that empowered me, and not power over, but to be with them, and to be able to continue in the struggle.
That's beautiful. Thank you. There were two or three things that I want to call out just from Sylvia's remarks there. Not power over, but power with, in the first place. This idea of struggle. Not movement, not action, not politics, struggle. Right, recognizing that it is both hard and it involves confrontation. It involves pushing against either interests or people or attitudes that are established, and that is never the path of least resistance. Right, but naming it as such, obviously in your case, gave you courage and made you feel that you had companions in the struggle. Right, and there's another word that you used in describing joining the struggle, and it's worth noting not only that the word was women. Right, we have this remarkable group of powerhouse women in this panel, in this conversation here, and one of the things I want to recognize is that the challenges of low-wage work in this country, particularly domestic work, oftentimes heavily in restaurant work, a lot of this low-wage work, home care work, the absence of dignity, the failure of people to look those workers in the eye, the absence of respect, is bound up incredibly powerfully with gender. It is bound up incredibly powerfully with the fact that such a great proportion of these workers are women. And one of the things that every one of us, has an obligation to do is to name that as well, and to call that out and to recognize that you may not be a low-wage worker, you may not be an immigrant, you may not be a person of color, but you may be a woman. You may have been descended from a woman. And you have an interest in recognizing the ways in which dignity and respect and being looked in the eye is something that every human, every woman, every citizen in a small C way that's not about documentation but is about membership in the community deserves and earns just by being a member of this community, right? And that so I just want to honor that dimension. And I want to close, actually, with you, Ai-Jen, with a thought that perhaps you can offer everybody here in the room. You opened this conference up by sharing this framework, not just these stories, but this framework for thinking about this work and about how it connects to every other aspect of civic engagement and civic life. Now I'd like you to tell us, everybody here, what can we do? Like, what are the one or two, three things that you would urge people in this room to go forth and do to help advance this cause, to help hasten this movement, and to help really propagate this idea that care is not a soft thing, it's not a thing that's over here, it's not a nice, it is the foundation of what it means for us to build a beloved community.
I think what we're trying to do in the care sector is something that we're hoping will ripple out through every sector in this economy, which is to really listen to and elevate low-wage workers as part of the solution, as protagonists in the economy that we need for all of us for the future. If you want to know what it looks like to have an economy that does actually work for all of us, if you want to know what economic democracy can look like and feel like, ask a low-wage worker what their vision for the future is. Ask them about their story. Ask them what it means to assert your dignity every day at work, when the rest of society is telling you that that is not dignified work. So I think it's about really opening up the space for all of us to see low-wage workers and the most invisible working people in our economy as protagonists in the new economy that we must create for all of us. And in the care industry, absolutely looking at the interdependence of the experience of our aging loved ones, our family members, families and workers together. Together is the only way that we will find the solutions that we need for the future. It's not us versus them, it's all of us all in. And I think that that's what we've been trying to build, is a movement that reflects that, that is expresses that in every way. And we hope that it's a model for other sectors throughout the economy and a bridge to the next conversation about race and racial justice.
Thank you so much. Please join me in thanking our panel of iGen, Sylvia, Susie, and Carmen. Thank you all so much.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you value this episode or this series, please share your appreciation by posting a good review. It'll help other listeners find us. The Citizen University National Conference took place at Seattle Center on March 20th and 21st, 2015. Sponsors included Seattle Center, the Seattle Foundation, and KUOW. Thanks again to Anna Tadashev for our recordings. Tune in next week for more great talks. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.